Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday. And we are talking about Stonehenge this hour of the program. If you've seen the current issue of National Geographic, they have a cover story titled Secrets of Stonehenge, If the Stones Could Speak, Searching for the Meaning of Stonehenge. It was probably, the article says, unique in its own time. Some 4,500 years ago, a stone monument that was modeled on timber precedents, and it is quite a story. People are trying to figure out why it was built and who built it, and we do know that some were farmers and pastoralists, and they had long since begun the task of domesticating their landscape, making inroads into the ancient birch, pine, and hazel forests. Skeletal remains indicate that despite physically demanding lives, the people of Neolithic Britain were more lightly built than us, and they probably, you know, had some strength to carry on these huge projects of building Stonehenge, which arose from a rich tradition of equally enigmatic structures. Henges, circular banks of earth paralleled by an internal ditch. And there, of course, as you know from this remarkable discovery in 2005, I believe, or 2004, not very far from Stonehenge is an exact replica of Stonehenge that was unearthed that is characterized with wood instead of with stone. So the thoughts are now that Stonehenge was a place to honor your ancestors, to think about the cycle of life and death, and then wood, which passes, was the place where people lived some distance from Stonehenge, and that was the place of life. So we're going to be talking about all of this Stonehenge this hour of our program today. We are happy to have with us Professor Julian Thomas. Professor Julian Thomas is an archaeologist with the University of Manchester in England, and his main research interests are concerned with the Neolithic period in Britain and Northwest Europe and with the theory and philosophy of archaeology. His major preoccupation throughout his career has been with finding ways of understanding prehistoric societies which confront the prejudices and the assumptions of the contemporary West. He is concerned with landscape and monumentality, the archaeology of death, the social role of material culture, the body, personhood, and identity, the relationship between archaeology and anthropology, and much more. He has been involved in field archaeology throughout his career, and he has been involved with, as one of the directors of the Stonehenge Riverside Project. If you saw the National Geographic special last night, you saw him actually in action at Stonehenge. He's vice chair of the Standing Committee for Archaeology, which represents university archaeology within the United Kingdom. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it was 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to join us by email, that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Julian Thomas, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a great pleasure to be here.
You know, it's just amazing how old this is, isn't it? 4,500 years is a long time ago.
It's astonishing, and it's fantastic when you stand there and think that there's something that is really representative of a culture so much unlike our own, just sitting there in the middle of Salisbury Plain right by the roadside.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine. Tell us again about, we did a show on this a couple of years ago, this remarkable discovery that was found not far from Stonehenge. What a find that was.
Well, that's fascinating, and it's always the way of it, that the things that are best are often the things that happen by mistake. So what we're interested in is trying to find out the relationship between Stonehenge and its river, and the relationship between Stonehenge and this other much larger henge monument at Durrington Walls, a couple of miles upriver. And we know that Stonehenge is connected to the River Avon by an avenue, and we were looking to see whether a similar avenue existed at Durrington Walls. Now, that was the case. We, fantastically enough, found that there is a 100-metre-long stone avenue with bank and ditch either side of it that connects Durrington Walls to its river, with the effect that Stonehenge and Durrington, the stone monument and the timber the two avenues and the river. So that was fantastic. That was what we were looking for in the first place. What we didn't expect was that when we uncovered the avenue, it was surrounded by little houses. And we've got eight of these now in the immediate area, just outside the eastern entrance of Durrington Walls. They're earlier than the bank and ditch of the Hinge itself, and they represent the largest Neolithic settlement that we've got anywhere on the British mainland. It's really quite unlike anything else we've got anywhere further south than, say, the Orkney Islands in northern Scotland.
Mm-hmm. And what you find at Durrington Walls, correct me if I'm wrong here, the structure that was built out of timber is very, very similar, if not almost a replica, of what you found at Stonehenge, and they were built at the same time?
Very much so. The southern circle is the largest of a number of timber structures in the area of Durrington Walls, and it's six concentric rings of timbers, the four innermost of which have pretty much the same diameters as the four inner stone settings at Stonehenge. So there's a great similarity. The other thing that really makes them similar is, of course, that they stand at the two ends of this pattern of movement, the avenues and the river. So they're complementary in a way. They're different materials, but they're similar spaces. The inner space of each one is much the same size, and that would mean that it would admit the same number of people. So you can imagine people moving at particular times of year between the two structures, starting out inside one and ending up in the other. And they also have complementary astronomical alignments.
Mm-hmm.
Midwinter sunrise for the Southern Circle, midsummer sunrise for Stonehenge. So that one of the things we think is extremely likely is the times at which you move between these two structures down the river are at these two key points in the year.
And people would gather, thousands of people would gather to these places to celebrate life and to thank ancestors for life and to commemorate death?
That's right. I mean, the fascinating thing about the settlement at Durrington Walls is it disappears under the bank of the slightly later Hinge Monument. And wherever people have dug into that bank, they found traces of settlement.
Hmm.
So it appears that this was an absolutely colossal settlement, very, very large indeed, surrounding a dry valley. In the middle of it, we have some more little houses, but houses that seem to have been elaborated by building palisades and banks and ditches around them, so that they may either have been the residences of very important people, or they may have been cult houses or ancestor houses or whatever. But this seems to have been a settlement that people are perhaps coming to seasonally. They don't appear to be there the whole year round. There are a whole series of aspects of the material residues that we have there that don't suggest year-round occupation. So it's a temporary place that people are coming to in very, very large numbers, perhaps at those two solstices, and they're engaged in feasting. There are pigs being killed in very large numbers and eaten. They're being barbecued. Hmm. They're being shot with arrows before they're eaten. And then there is this pattern of movement between the two monuments. So mm-hmm. there's something going on there that's really very significant for mm-hmm. the people.
And you found thousands of artifacts, didn't you? These are very old, and thousands of them.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a bit of a dream for us because...
I'll bet.
I'm sorry?
I said I'll bet it was a dream
for you. Well, absolutely, because if you deal with this period, the Neolithic, the New Stone Age, usually when you excavate a site, you deal with relatively modest numbers of artifacts. So this is very different to what we're used to.
And some of the arrows, you point out the fact that it was not an entirely peaceful society. You found bones with arrows that had been in the legs. It was kind of brutal in a way.
Well, yeah, very interesting. One of the houses had a pit cut through it, and in that pit there were large numbers of animal bones. But in amongst it, one human leg bone with the points of a number of arrows stuck in it. And strange is that the date that we get from that, the radiocarbon date from the bone, seems to be rather older than the animal bone from the same pit. So it appears that this is a human bone of someone who's met a very nasty end, but their bone has then been curated, looked after, been in circulation for a period after death. So as well as being evidence of some very unpleasant activity going on, it's also evidence of a desire to hang on to the remains of people who've died in an unusual manner.
Mm-hmm. And you decided, isn't it funny how much of life is just sort of by chance, but someone decided to look outside the hinge to find these houses when you assumed that it was going to be inside?
Well, hinges generally aren't imagined to be residences at all. As you said at the beginning, one of the peculiar things about them is that unlike a defensive structure, the bank is outside of the ditch. So one way of thinking about that is if you've got a hill fort or some kind of defensive structure, you have a defense which is intended to keep something out. With a hinge, it's almost as if you're trying to keep something in. So it's almost as if you're setting up a very special space which keeps maybe supernatural influences inside.
Hmm. How long did it take to build Stonehenge?
Well, a very long period of time. It was played out over centuries, really, because the bank and ditch, and we now know also the Aubrey holes that run round immediately inside the bank and ditch, were constructed a little bit after 3000 BC, but then the stones start turning up about 500 years after that. And then there's a constant process of moving the stones around, putting them into slightly different configurations. So although each particular episode of construction might not have taken a very long period of time, people clearly imagine that this is a place of great importance. And it's almost as if different generations are trying to slightly change the structure, or in some cases radically change the structure, as their own requirements change.
Hmm. It would have to be a place of special importance, wouldn't it, because of the loss of life involved in getting those stones there, the difficulty of getting those stones there. This was hard work, to say
the
least.
Absolutely. But it's almost as if that difficulty, that extremity of experience that's involved in bringing the stones there is part of what gives them their value.
Hmm. Right. And tell me about the idea of the stones representing the ancestors who are going to give fertility, and you go to Stonehenge to say thank you for the fertile ground. And then you've got the other area where it's built in timber, which is more symbolic of the transitory nature of existence.
Sure. This is an idea that goes back to the work of my colleague Mike Parker Pearson, who's one of the other directors on the Stonehenge Riverside Project. He's done a lot of ethnographic work out in Madagascar. And back in 1984, he was at the World Archaeological Congress in Southampton with a Madagascan colleague called Ramil Sanina. And the two of them went on a field trip to Stonehenge. And they were walking around Stonehenge. And Ramil said to him, well, of course, this is a place of the ancestors, isn't it? So Mike did a sort of double take and said, well, what's that all about? And he said, well, back home in Madagascar, stones are put up to the ancestors, and stone tombs are the places of the ancestors, whereas the living live in houses made of timber. And the reason for this is, he says, that because stones are like the hard, solid bones of the dead, whereas wood is softer and it decays away like the bodies of the living. And the way that we think about life is a process of hardening. You start out as a baby very soft and damp, and through life you get progressively harder and harder and harder until you end up as an ancestor and you're very hard indeed.
Oh my.
And they argued on that basis that when you look at the relationship between Stonehenge, which has stones and very little in the way of evidence of feasting or consumption, not much animal bone, not much pottery, you compare that with Durrington Wall's timber structures, lots and lots of evidence of consumption. Well, maybe there's a relationship here that's a parallel with that at in Madagascar, where there's a complementarity between places of the living and places of the dead. If you then go back to that evidence that we've found of a connection between the two monuments, well, then moving between the place of the living and the place of the dead is, well, that's what the dead do. That's the road that the dead travel down as they go to join the community of the ancestors.
Hmm. And what about the burials at Stonehenge? Are there many of those?
Yes, this is very interesting. Back in the 1920s, when Colonel Hawley was excavating there, a lot of cremation burials were uncovered, some of them in the Aubrey Holes and some of them in the bank and ditch surrounding Stonehenge. And at that time, there wasn't an awful lot that you could do with that kind of material. So of the 52 cremations that were excavated at that time, 49 were put straight back into the ground. Well, in the 1930s, they were reburied in one of the Aubrey Holes, so just a few have survived. Just recently, in the past 5 years or so, we've had new forms of radiocarbon dating, which enable us to date cremation. So that's quite unusual, because radiocarbon dating works on organic materials, and usually you can date unburnt bone because you're dating the organic fraction of the bone, the collagen. Now there's a new technique which enables you to date cremations, and we found very interestingly that one of the cremations that comes out of one of the Aubrey Holes dates back almost to 3000 BC.
Goodness.
So right at the very beginning of the activity at Stonehenge, long before the stones get there. And it does appear that sporadically there was burial going on at Stonehenge over a period of 500 or 600 years. Now, what's interesting about that is we've got those 52 cremations from the excavation of half of Stonehenge. There might be another 50, there might be maybe another 100, maybe even more. But even so, that spread over 500 or 600 years isn't an awful lot of burials. So that's telling us that not everyone in this society was being buried there. There's got to be some choice going on about precisely who's going into the ground. So one argument that's been put forward in the press is, well, maybe this is the burial of some kind of a royal family. Maybe there's some kind of a dynasty here, mm-hmm. so that only one or two people are being buried in each generation. But alternatively, we could think of a whole series of other possibilities. Maybe it's the priests, maybe it's the wise people, maybe it's people who occupy important positions in the kinship system or descent system in this society.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know, and that's why it would be really nice to know more about those cremations that have been buried. Is there any hint of biological relatedness between these people, for example?
Ah, yes. We're going to welcome phone calls for you in just one moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Professor Julian Thomas is our guest this hour, and we're talking about Stonehenge and the recent discoveries there, just remarkable discoveries. He's with the University of Manchester in England, and he is also one of the directors of the Stonehenge Riverside Project. They are undertaking a re-excavation of the southern timber circle within the Great Henge of Durrington Walls, and in 2006 investigated two enclosures inside the Durrington Monument, which proved to contain, can you imagine this discovery, small buildings surrounded by timber palisades. He's vice chair of the Standing Committee for Archaeology, which represents university archaeology within the United Kingdom. I'm sure that many of you listening have been to Stonehenge, or if you haven't, you've learned a lot about it, because it is one of those places on earth that fills us with great wonder, and we wonder why it was built, how in the world people 4,500 years ago could build these structures, and we'll talk more about that, the rock that was used and why certain rock was used and how they carried these rocks from 25 to 30 miles away. It was a tremendous feat of engineering for prehistoric people. It's a pretty interesting story, huh? Here's our number. Call us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The Secrets of Stonehenge featured on the cover of the National Geographic for the month of June. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. We're talking about the remarkable and quite recent new discoveries at Stonehenge, the Secret of Stonehenge, the cover story of National Geographic. For those of you who have been there or who have thought about it, and a lot of people have thought about it. What happened here? Why were these built? How did these stones get there? How did people drag them? What was the society like in 4500 BC? This, of course, is one of the, well, it is the most remarkable prehistoric, I think, site in most of Europe, Stonehenge is. So call us. And some of you have been there and probably have questions yourselves. We also have an email address you can use, which is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we are very happy to have a gentleman who's been doing excavating, who's thought about this for a long time, Professor Julian Thomas, who's an archaeologist with the University of Manchester, and he is also with his organization. Most recently, he's become one of the directors of the Stonehenge Riverside Project, who's been investigating Durrington Walls, which we've discussed a little bit. So call us. Don't be silent. We'd like to hear from you. Everybody who sees Stonehenge and who sees the picture on National Geographic or watches the story can't believe that people got these huge, huge rocks. Start with, and they're all different kinds of rocks for different kinds of purposes. Tell me about the building process, and then, of course, the process of transporting these enormous rocks that weighed tons and tons. What a project.
Well, absolutely, but important to remember it's two different projects, that there's two different kinds of stones at Stonehenge. There are the blue stones, which come from the Preseli Hills in Wales, which is a long, long way off. And then there are sarsens, which are native to the chalk. And there's an ongoing debate about how near to Stonehenge some of the sarsens may have come from. I mean, really large ones, it's quite likely that you have to go maybe 20 miles north of the Marlborough Downs. But one of the things that's been coming out of our work, again, looking at other sites in the Stonehenge area, is that there do seem to be native sarsens in the Stonehenge area. And we've actually excavated two standing stones within sight of Durrington Walls, one on Bulford Hill and one away at the Cuckoo Stone, just next to Durrington Walls. In both cases, these seem to be stones that have been pulled up out of the ground, stood upright, and then over a long period of time they've become very important. They've attracted activity over hundreds of years. People have buried people, cremated in urns in the early Bronze Age. One of them has had a Roman temple constructed right next to it. So the stones are very important. Stones are more than just building material. The process of construction, well, the large sarsen stones at Stonehenge itself weigh upwards of 40 tons.
Whew.
So that is a major piece of work. Now, exactly how it was that they got them upright, exactly how it was they moved them from place to place is, again, another one of these debates that goes on and on. I've seen some work suggesting that the actual erection of the stones involved the use of an A-frame and just a lot of people pulling on a rope. Moving them around, it's always been suggested that this has been done with rollers. But again, some of the work recently has suggested that you could get a better effect by laying timbers almost as rails and making sure you've just got lots and lots of animal fat to make the stones move. And then, again, it's just lots and lots of people on the end of ropes. Now, I think the interesting point about all that is not so much the engineering as the social aspect of what's happening. Because if you've got to get hundreds and hundreds of people together in order to pull those stones, mm-hmm. you've also got to feed them, you've got to have people who are making the ropes, you've got to have all kinds of logistics in place, and this becomes more than just, an engineering exercise. It's a whole social process of mobilizing all those people, making them want to do the job,
mm-hmm.
And making sure that things don't go wrong, because, now, again, these are more than just stones. They're objects which have some kind of spiritual or perhaps ancestral resonance to them. The substance of them is of symbolic significance. And if something goes wrong, it's not just a happenstance. It may mean that presiding deities or spirits are unhappy.
Mm.
And if one of the stones falls over, people get killed,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to be very difficult, presumably, to get the project going again. It may indicate that perhaps the whole thing is ill-fated.
Mm. The movie last night intimated that it was considered an honor to be part of this project. Would you agree with that, and why would that be the case?
I think that's very likely. There's a whole series of ways that you can imagine what the basis was for being involved. I think, yes, coming a long distance and being involved in the construction of a monument that is to the glory of ancestors or deities or spirits. That's one way in which you might do it. Equally, you might look on the labour that's involved in constructing such a monument as a debt or an obligation or a gift. There's a whole series of ways in which the socialness of this labour needs to be considered, I think.
Mm-hmm. And how did they know they're travelling all this distance to get these stones? How do they know what size they ought to be? They had to be fairly perfect, didn't they?
Well, I think that's right. I think that they have to have a fairly clear idea of what those stones are going to be like. But also, bear in mind that these stones have been worked at a certain time, that they've used big hammer stones and they've used smoothing stones as well on the surfaces. So to begin with, those stones would have been more varied in their size and in their shape.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a lot of people died in this process?
I think it's entirely likely. Again, that's the kind of thing that you can never really know, but I think it's extremely likely that this kind of activity would have been very, very dangerous indeed, not to mention being out in all weathers, moving these things from one place to another.
Right. And you also, the article looks at the drive that you'd have to do this, to take on such a journey. Can you explain that? You've thought about that a lot, I'm sure. Why would people do this?
Well, again, it's much easier to come up with possibilities,
right,
to be precise about which one it is. The obvious argument is there must have been someone very, very powerful who was in a position to tell other people what to do.
Mm.
The counter-argument is, well, maybe it's not so much a powerful person as a powerful belief or a powerful understanding. So as soon as you're starting to deal with areas to do with ritual, religion, the supernatural, and so on, then maybe it's simply that the power of belief is making people do things. But equally, you could imagine a combination of the two, that people achieve a position of authority or a position of power because they have control over religious belief, ritual practice, or whatever. So there's all sorts of different possibilities.
Hmm. We have an email. Given all that Stonehenge represents in complexity, engineering, and abstract thought, could we safely infer that Homo sapiens' brains have for 6,000 plus or minus years evolved much at all, if not one little bit? If so, for good or ill, could the construction of Stonehenge be a sample of our insatiable appetite for dominance of others, while at the same time acting on our intense curiosity about all things technical and religious?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, that you have to remember that these people are in many ways much like ourselves. Their capabilities are much like our own. They're not a different species of humanity. Dominance, well, that's an interesting question. Is it that these things are being put up because someone is wanting to exert their power? One of the things that interests me throughout this whole project is that we always tend to think of monuments as a kind of an imposition of culture on nature. So they're a massive statement of our presence and our control, our manipulation of nature.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, looking at the detail of many of these monuments, you find that the relationship with the topography is actually very intimate and very subtle. So Stonehenge itself is positioned in a particular location where you get a good view of a particular hilltop, Beacon Hill. And that same hilltop is visible from an awful lot of the monuments in the same landscape. Think also about the river and the way in which the avenues are connected to the river, so that as you go between Stonehenge and Durrington Walls, you're actually going over or through the water. And that means, I think, necessarily, that people who are going between those two places are going through some kind of transition or transformation. There's a sense of a changing of your character as you go from place to place. But that also suggests to me, well, is it that the avenues are understood as being much the same thing as the river? So again, is it that rather than being an imposition on the landscape, these monuments are threaded into the landscape, and the way in which they're using stone and earth and chalk and all these natural materials, it's like a kind of cosmological engineering, if you like.
Hmm.
So I'd look on it less as domination, as a way in which people are engineering their own cosmos in microcosm.
How long a distance is it from Stonehenge to Durrington Walls?
I think it's about a couple of miles, mm-hmm. that kind of distance, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting thing about it is it's almost as if they've deliberately chosen the stretch of the river which is the most wiggly and sinuous, so that if you're going from one monument to the other, down your avenues, down into the water, or along the water on boats, or along the riverside, the passage between the two avenues is very, very sinuous, and there are also quite substantial river cliffs up on either side in some places. And we now know from excavations that we did last summer, our colleague Josh Pollard, working immediately south of Durrington Walls, has found a series of very large late Neolithic post settings which would have overlooked the river. So I think they're drawing attention to the process of moving from one monument to the other, and they're making it a very sensorily rich experience. Now, imagine that you were going, say, at night between these two places, or imagine that you're going and you're seeing fires lit on the river cliffs above you. It becomes a very, as I say, very rich, mm-hmm. very, very sensuous experience moving from one place to the other.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more, if you know more here, about who the people, thousands would come here. Were they all from this part of England? Did they come from other parts of Europe?
That's a really, really interesting question. We're starting to get some evidence, just beginning to get some evidence that is really starting to tell us something about that. We have cattle jaws from Durrington Walls in particular, on which we've done molecular analysis on isotopes, which tells us that those cattle were not raised on the chalk, that they've come from quite large distances away, and that they've probably come from a number of different directions. So coming back to what I was saying about the settlement at Durrington being a place that people were coming to perhaps seasonally, well, it's quite likely that they're coming quite substantial distances. There's also evidence from other sites which is suggesting that, again, people are moving quite substantial distances between, say, the Wessex Uplands and the Mendip Hills, for instance. Now, a little later on, once you get into what's called the Beaker period, where you have a very different kind of mortuary practice going on, we have, again, isotopic evidence from burials in the Stonehenge area, which is suggesting that there are people moving around even larger distances. There are people turning up in the Stonehenge area who are almost certainly coming in from the European continent.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the question is this groups of people, is this migration, or is it individual people moving between population groups? Again, look at the anthropology, and it's very likely that you're seeing people moving from place to place through marriages, through all kinds of alliance relationships between communities. I think we have an idea of prehistory that we get from the medieval period, really, where we imagine that people are staying in much the same place, that they're living their whole life in a single village, that their horizons are very limited. Everything that we're getting out of the evidence now is telling us that's not the case, and that people are actually moving considerable distances through their lifetimes. And that may explain why particular kinds of artifacts and monuments are similar very often over extremely large distances.
Isn't that something? What a hard thing to do that must have been so many years ago. That must have been just terribly hard work.
Absolutely, going all those distances.
Right.
And your knowledge of those other places at this time is going to be limited because you don't have maps, you don't have GPS, you don't have anything other than myths and stories to tell you what those other places are like. But I think that's going to be very important because you're going to gain an understanding of far-off places as mythic or as the homes of gods. So when objects come from those places, when you exchange axes or pots from very great distances, it's almost going to be as if these are objects that have come from the gods.
Well, ask Professor Julian Thomas if Stonehenge is indeed the most significant monument, prehistoric monument in all of Europe in a moment. And welcome your phone calls. You're incredibly silent today. I don't know why. Maybe you're just finding the story as fascinating as I am. Professor Julian Thomas is an archaeologist with the University of Manchester and most recently has become one of the directors of the Stonehenge Riverside Project. They have undertaken a re-excavation of the southern timber circle within the Great Henge of Durrington Walls, and a lot of this has happened fairly recently. What they have found, the artifacts, are just extraordinary, and now they're beginning to think about finding out more information about who gathered at Durrington Walls. They found houses at Durrington Walls and exactly similar to Stonehenge monument that was done in timber. So the idea is that Stonehenge was honoring ancestors, the stones, the permanency of death, and the timber, which is softer and is more of a symbol of the living. So the film, if you saw it last night, looked at the great feast that took place at Durrington Walls and gave an idea of what the society was like 4,500 years ago. Give us a call if you'd like to. If not, I'm having a good time talking. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Current cover of National Geographic has a story on Stonehenge, which you may also have seen, Secrets of Stonehenge. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll welcome more of your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Actually, start your phone calls, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. And our calls start with Louise from Milwaukee. Hi, Louise. Hi, Louise. Are you there? Well, Louise isn't there. We'll get somebody else on because the lines are jammed up now. What do you think about putting this in terms of importance of prehistoric monuments in Europe? Is this the biggie, Professor Thomas? There's nothing quite like Stonehenge?
Well, there's nothing like it because it's so unusual. I think there's always a temptation to look on your own monument in your own land and that you happen to be working on as the most important place. But I think it's also quite important to recognize that what's going on here is perhaps a little bit parochial, a little bit specific to Northwest Europe, and quite different to things that are happening at the same time in say, the Mediterranean, where you have much, much larger societies. Perhaps different kinds of monuments, perhaps not so impressive in the same way. But in another way, we're pretty much out on a limb on the edge of Europe at this time.
Mm-hmm. And when did it stop being used, and why?
Well, that's a really good question, because it depends on what you mean by used. Certainly by, I don't know, a little after 2000 BC, there's not much going on there at Stonehenge, and there seem to be big changes going on in the landscape around it, so that rather than there being very large, long barrows that we've had in the early Neolithic or hinge monuments and other structures in the late Neolithic, you start to get, in the early Bronze Age, cemeteries of small round mounds with single burials inside them. And one of the arguments that's made is that instead of a very centralized, very large-scale society, or at least periodically a society that can organize people to create very large field works like Stonehenge, you're moving to a more fragmented, more small-scale, more competitive society with the introduction of metalwork, with the introduction of ways of expressing personal prestige and power. But it still, despite that, people are relating to the old monument in various ways, so that you find that in the area around Stonehenge itself, there are a whole series of little barrow cemeteries, all of which are placed precisely so that they get a view of Stonehenge. So Stonehenge may no longer be a place that you're going to, but it's a place that you want to reference. It's a place that still is recognized as having an importance, but it's the importance of somewhere that is connected with the far past now.
Interesting. Bill from Appleton, hi.
Good morning. actually, your guest's last comment has to do with my question. There are a number of other sites in the area. I think Avesbury rings a bell, and then there's also a giant chalk mound that's only about a quarter of a, or a half a mile from a long barrel. And I'm wondering, what are the relationships, you know, in time and in culture to some of these other sites and Stonehenge?
Yeah, it's a good question. You're right about Avesbury, very similar to Durrington Walls, one of a number of these very, very large henge monuments. There are a couple more of them. There's one at Mount Pleasant down near Dorchester in Dorset. And the large mound you're talking about, I think, is probably Silbury Hill, which is, again, right next to the Avesbury Henge. Now, these things are more or less contemporary. They're growing up at much the same time. And, again, you can look at them in a number of different ways. Is it that you've got a number of different groups who are in competition with each other? So is it that you've got territorial communities who are each trying to outdo each other with more and more complex monuments over time? And that, you know, that has a certain amount of resonance, because at Avesbury you have an enormous henge monument. The ditch is much, much deeper than at any of the other henges, and you have huge avenues of stones added, leading away towards other monuments, the sanctuary on Overton Hill, for instance. And you have stones inside the henge at Avesbury, which you don't have so much at Durrington. Now, you might see, as I say, that that's a way of competing, or you might equally say that given that we're aware that people are only present at some of these places for part of the year, and there does seem to be this emphasis on the solstices at Durrington Walls and Stonehenge, is it that these are, again, complementary structures that people are simply going to at different times? And again, if it appears that the people are not based specifically in one area and they're moving around quite a bit, is it that there are different times of year at which you go to different centres and engage in different kinds of ceremonial activities?
Oh, that's interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Bill from Elm Grove is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, good morning. I didn't hear the whole show, so I don't know if you mentioned this, but about the same time as Stonehenge, it looks like the pyramids in Egypt were built, and I mean, talk about something monumental. The pyramids, as far as they still don't know how they were built and how they erected these huge stones and precise angles and this type of thing. So, is there any comment about comparing the two?
Well, that's an interesting question. And there was a time when people used to look at something like Stonehenge, or look at the megalithic tombs that we have in Britain and Northwest Europe in general, and want to imagine that they'd been built by people who had come from somewhere in the East Mediterranean. So they'd compare these monuments with either the Tholos tombs in Greece or the pyramids or whatever, and say, well, these were Mycenaean or Egyptian architects who were coming out and showing the barbarians how it's done. I think we've moved away from that now. We want to look at Stonehenge very much as something that emerges in its own local context and tells us something about the specific society of southern Britain in that ancient time. But I think there are important similarities in that you're dealing with early state or pre-state societies, societies in which monuments have a really important role in maintaining authority, maintaining memory, maintaining the relations between the different generations in a way that we don't really need now when we live in large nation-state societies. So I think there's definitely that similarity, that the importance of monumentality as a means of maintaining social relations over time.
Mm. Thanks for your call. Adam from Oshkosh is next. Hi, Adam.
Hi, and thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just have a quick question for the guest. Through the discoveries recently at Stonehenge, are you finding that people are disappointed that Stonehenge doesn't have more supernatural origins or supernatural sort of application as people once believed or wanted to believe?
Yeah, good question. I think people don't necessarily imagine that the kinds of things that we're finding out necessarily contradict all of those views. I think it's quite possible to have a whole series of different ideas about a monument like this and not necessarily see them as conflicting. So, for instance, there are ideas about the power and the efficacy of the stones. Well, I think it's very likely that people in the Neolithic thought exactly that, that the stones were not just building material, but they embodied different kinds of cosmic power, for want of a better term, or spiritual power. Now, I may not necessarily believe that myself, but you know, I think it has a role in any kind of explanation that we want to put forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, which are the ones that turn blue when it rains?
Ah, the blue stones, the ones from
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
Well, you could see why people would think that would be somewhat supernatural.
Absolutely, and
right?
I think the mere fact that you've brought these stones such a long distance, it's telling us that these are not just being brought as building materials. And you could certainly go a lesser distance and get stronger, tougher stones that had better mechanical properties. That's not the reason they're doing it. Mm-hmm. Similarly, you know, people are exchanging stone axes over enormous distances in Neolithic Britain, and you can get a perfectly good axe from half a mile away. The importance of bringing materials from great distances, I think, is very considerable in this period. Going back to what I was saying about the kind of mythic or supernatural character of faraway places, the fact that the stones or axes or anything have come from great distance is part of what gives them their value and their significance.
Mm-hmm. Jerry from Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Good morning, Kathleen. I read a book recently on this subject called Inside the Neolithic Mind, and I'm sorry I don't remember the two authors' names, but they were, I believe, anthropologists from South Africa. And they had studied burial sites all over the world and found a common thread that runs through them. And the basic premise of their book was that mankind is pre-wired to believe in some sort of an afterlife. I don't know if your guest has read this book, but would he comment on that?
Sure, yeah. It's a book by David Lewis Williams. I read it. It's a very interesting idea that's being put forward. They're talking specifically about shamanism and altered consciousness and the idea that there are universal mental states that turn up in all societies that have ever existed, and that much of what's happening in Neolithic monuments, particularly chambered tombs, is to do with these altered states and the way that these altered states are understood as giving you some kind of communion with the cosmic powers. I'm not sure that I'm entirely happy with the kind of universal aspects of that. I'm more interested in the specific and the particular context. And while I do think, yes, that in many of these monuments, altered states of consciousness may be part of what's going on, the idea that that is the principal motivation or the principal reason why these things are being constructed in the way that they are, I'm more skeptical about.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jerry, so much for your call. Jeff from Superior is next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Well, first of all, great show, and I've been to Stonehenge years ago, and I had a question that kind of goes back to an earlier topic in the show about these cremation burials. My question is there a way of testing these to determine whether or not there's the presence of grave goods or something like that to indicate that these are people of higher status? I just got my master's degree in medieval history a little while ago, and I think archaeology might have been more up my alley. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Jeff.
Yeah, good point. Certainly, we do know that in these late Neolithic cremation cemeteries, you do get grave goods. Not always very large numbers of them. One of the things that's very interesting from Stonehenge itself is that one of the cremations had a stone mace head associated with it. And that's very interesting because that cries out that it may be some kind of a symbol of power or authority. The kinds of things you find more often, though, are things like bone or antler pins, which may actually be shroud pins. And you get little stone artifacts, arrowheads in some cases, but this this masthead is possibly quite a significant piece of information.
Hmm. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Are you doing work over the summer?
We are. We're back again in late August and into September.
Mm-hmm. Who knows what you'll find this year, Professor?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Professor Julian Thomas, archaeologist with the University of Manchester. He was also featured in the National Geographic film that was on last night on Stonehenge, which is also featured in this month's magazine, the June magazine, Secrets of Stonehenge. Professor Julian Thomas is vice chair of the Standing Committee for Archaeology, which represents university archaeology within the United Kingdom, and he is one of the directors of the Stonehenge Riverside Project. We thank him so much for being with us. Interesting. It's interesting, isn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to John Anderson for on-air production. He's our new intern for the summer here, so say hello to him when you call in. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11. Lots of interesting conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.